From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the growing case against a former MSU doctor accused of sexually assaulting young gymnasts for nearly 20 years.
Somebody found their way into that special community and took advantage of young people at their most vulnerable points in time.
Kalamazoo brewer Larry Bell and the new alliance of Michigan business owners determined to shut down Enbridge Line 5.
Enbridge is a very large company. They are very polished. They have mouthpieces pieces that know how to manage media quite well. They will kind of stop at nothing to get their way with things.
The East Lansing history professor who helped director Martin Scorsese tell the story of Jesuit missionaries in 17th century Japan.
To see it on the screen is really amazing.
Those stories and more, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The story broke last September, broken by the Indianapolis Star. Complaints that a Michigan State University sports physician has been sexually assaulting young gymnasts for nearly 20 years.
His treatment would include what he's calling a vaginal adjustment that would allegedly treat their back injuries, their hip injuries, and sometimes injuries not associated with the spine or hips at all, but he would tell the girls things like, you know, what I'm doing is okay. Don't tell your family. They wouldn't understand.
To date, over 60 women and girls have stepped forward to tell police they were sexually assaulted by Dr. Larry Nassar. More than 30 have filed civil lawsuits against Michigan State and Dr. Nassar, who is now in the Ingham County Jail, facing federal and state charges of sexual assault and child pornography. Lansing area attorney Jamie White represents 10 of Dr. Nassar's alleged victims, and that includes a current scholarship member of the MSU women's gymnastics team. And before we begin, a quick warning, the topic we're going to discuss may not be suitable for our young listeners. Jamie, what is Dr. Nassar's defense?
Well, I think what you're going to hear and what we have heard over the course of the last several months is that there is some sort of medical procedure that he was performing on these women, and that this procedure is appropriate and it's been accepted in the medical community. And I can tell you, we have spent an enormous amount of time trying to find someone inside the medical community to support this, and to date we've been unsuccessful.
Michigan State University denies knowing of any complaints before 2014. Is that believable to you?
No. I don't believe that that's supported by common sense, and more importantly, it's not supported by the allegations of certain victims who have gone on the record and indicated that, in fact, they did come out to Michigan State University, albeit through their coaches, their trainers, or other representatives, expressing their concerns, and those concerns were ultimately, you know, either not heard or disregarded in their entirety.
So we know Michigan State fired Dr. Nassar last fall. President Luana K. Simon sent out a letter saying the school is taking a proactive approach and it's conducting an investigation. Coach Klages was suspended yesterday. So let's talk about this investigation. It's the MSU Police Department leading the probe?
That is my understanding. At this point in time, the investigation is being handled by the Michigan State University Police Department. And the prosecution, and I think it's important to sort of point out that we have a couple of different things going on here at the same time. There is what you've referenced in the opening. There's the criminal prosecution of Mr. Nassar that's being handled by the Attorney General for the state of Michigan as it pertains to allegations that he, in fact, committed criminal sexual conduct in the first degree on an individual either 12 years or younger. That's ongoing here in the state of Michigan, here in Ingham County. We also have the federal prosecution of Mr. Nassar that's being led up by the FBI, and that process is ongoing as well. And then we have the civil process, which is the young victims, and not all young at this point in time, but the victims nonetheless have asked for civil relief. So getting back to your question in regards to the investigation, I do think it's important that your listeners in the community understand that we are talking about different facets as it pertains to Michigan State University and its involvement in the investigation. I can only speak for myself and my firm, you know, and the victims that I represent, and I do think I speak for other counsel, but I'll let them do that themselves, that as it pertains to the criminal investigation in isolation, Michigan State University police have been extraordinary. They've been diligent in seeking out young victims for the purpose of getting their statement on the record and ultimately bringing Mr. Nassar to justice. So, you know, any confusion in any way, shape, or form that, you know, they have not been exemplary in those efforts certainly is not supported by me, and they should be commended for their efforts. With that said, you know, we have a much broader picture that we believe there's been a failure to fully comprehend or accept, and that is that, you know, we have these allegations that the university knew or should have known. And quite frankly, at least what's been made public at this point in time, that investigation has been minuscule or non-existent. I can give you a few examples. You know, so well, let me back up a little bit. So we know that there was an investigation, at least in 2014, of Dr. Nassar, the details of which have yet to be made completely public, but if we accept what's been made public to date, we know that Dr. Nassar, for the, you know, the third or at least fourth time, the university had been put on some form of notice that some young person was alleging that what he was doing was inappropriate and they were troubled by this.
And this was the four-doctor panel investigation?
That's correct.
And we don't know anything about that. Why is that?
That's a very good question. You know, at some point in time, we do intend and hope to have all of the information related to that investigation. But what we do know that as a result of that, there were some form of protocols put in place to supervise the ongoings of Dr. Nassar. We know that those protocols included that he have some other professional inside the room with him anytime that he was with a patient. And we know that those protocols were not followed. So, I mean, that's one prime example of facts that I do not believe in are in dispute from any party at this point in time. And I think it goes to the credibility of the university investigating itself.
Jamie, you want Attorney General Bill Schuette to step in and ask an outside law enforcement agency to take over from the MSU police. Is that correct?
So I did have a conference with Attorney Schuette's office indicating my general concerns that not only the specifics that I've outlined here, but just from the standpoint of general optics, you know, that I think it's in the best interest of the victims, it's in the best interest of the university that a third party step in and participate in this investigation. And, you know, again, it's important to note, you know, at this point, I don't believe that it would be productive for the university to step back from working with the victims as they grapple with the criminal process and prosecuting Dr. Nassar. The detectives have spent countless hours and days and hundreds of miles of travel investigating this issue. And, you know, to pull those detectives away from that, I think would be counterproductive. These young women have come to grow comfortable with these detectives. These detectives have intimate knowledge as it pertains to the criminal prosecution. So I do believe that it would be helpful to have a third party assist the MSU Police Department in that endeavor. But I don't believe there's anything that I'm aware of that would disqualify them from continuing to participate in that role.
And has the AG's office been responsive? Are you getting a sense that that would happen, that he would ask an outside agency, or does he want to step back?
So in my conference with the Attorney General's office, in expressing my concerns, you know, as it pertains to everything that we've already talked mm-hmm. about, what was relayed to me was that my concerns were heard and that there is an understanding of the potential for problems based on what I presented, but that the Attorney General had no authority to make that decision.
You know, we remember history. It took an independent investigator. It was former FBI Director Louis Freeh to rip the veil off of the J.R.E. Sandusky disaster at Penn State. And one has to wonder, why can't Michigan State pay for an outside investigator? We know they've done it in the past with individual sexual assault complaints, because we reported on that.
Correct. You know, I mean, there clearly is nothing to... So while Mr. Schuette says that, or Mr. Schuette's office says that they have no authority, you know, there's certainly nothing to stop the top law enforcement agency in the state of Michigan from reaching out and saying, hey, you know, I can't force you to do this, but, you know, we believe it's in the best interest that there be some association with another law enforcement agency in addition to the efforts that have already been put forth, or, as you've described, bringing in a third party as they did in Penn State, which ultimately led to a resolution for the parties.
And in that case, a final thought from you. We saw at Penn State that Jerry Sandusky was surrounded by a culture that let him get away with that sexual abuse for decades. Is this on the level of Penn State?
Clearly, we have similarities. You know, we have two Big Ten universities that at least it appears over the course of a significant period of time, several years, somebody found their way into that special community and took advantage of young people at their most vulnerable points in time. You know, at Michigan State, we have these young women who have some have been training since the age of 3 years old, the vast majority of which had at least ambitions of a college scholarship and some had Olympic dreams. So Dr. Nasser was a big piece of this promise. You know, he was a big, his picture was on the wall in the gym. You know, Michigan State's website was replete with, you know, accolades regarding Dr. Nasser. And these women were vulnerable in a very different sense. You know, they were very strong, they were very motivated. And, you know, there was this sort of rubber stamp that if you're going to be a successful candidate for whatever level of gymnastics they aspire to, you had to follow the certain road. You know, where Penn State, at least in large part, Mr. Sandusky was preying on maybe a more vulnerable type of crowd from a layperson's point of view, in that he had his charity and, you know, they worked with youth who maybe were troubled. So the similarities are obviously very clear, but the distinction between the two victim groups are very different. And I just hope that members of our community and your listeners will hold these young women up in the same regard as the victims at Penn State.
Lansing area attorney Jamie White, who represents 10 of the alleged victims of Dr. Larry Nasser. Jamie, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
And we reached out to Attorney General Bill Schuette's office for clarification on their stance about having a third party investigate the university's handling of this affair. We did not hear back, and we were unable to reach Michigan State University by airtime today for a response to this interview. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Director Martin Scorsese's latest film is Silence, set in 17th century Japan. Two young Jesuit priests from Portugal, played by Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver, go to Japan to search for their lost mentor, Father Ferreira.
Ferreira is lost to us. He denounced God in public and surrendered the faith.
That's not possible. Father Ferreira risked his life to spread our faith all over Japan.
It seems to me that our mission here is more urgent than ever. We must go find Father Ferreira.
This is in your hearts, then, both of you?
Yes.
Then I must trust God has put it down. The moment you set foot in that country, you step into high danger.
The film is based on Shusaku Endo's 1966 novels. It's been nominated for an Oscar for cinematography. And when it came to getting the details right, Scorsese and his team turned to Michigan State University history professor Liam Brocky, who is with us now. Liam, this is your area of study?
Yes, it is. I work on missionaries in Asia in the 16th and 17th century, so this is precisely what I work on.
So what did you think when you heard that Martin Scorsese was actually making this film?
I was very excited about it, but it's a topic that is very, very unknown to most people that would see Hollywood movies. So I was really surprised that they were going to make this movie. But when they did, I was very enthusiastic about it. And even when I heard the first murmurs of that this might be made into a movie, I contacted Martin Scorsese's production company to suggest that I might be of help, not that I thought they were ever going to respond.
And then they did.
And then they did, yes. They were very enthusiastic, actually, because I guess they realized that I actually do work on this topic and I know something about it beyond what you could find on the internet.
In fact, your book, The Visitor, Andre Palmiero and the Jesuits in Asia, was actually about someone who wrote to the historical figure whose story inspired the novel.
Exactly. The figure of Father Ferreira, as they call him. He begins and ends my book, The Visitor, because basically my book is about his boss, his superior, who comes to East Asia to find out how the Jesuits are doing their missions. And this is sort of the last great challenge that Palmiero faces, is how to deal with the story of an apostasy.
Yes, give us a nutshell for those who have not seen it. We know that we have these two young priests, and they want to find their lost mentor. They fear he has been completely lost, that he has stepped away from his faith. But kind of give us a sense of what the story is about.
Well, the story is the end, the very, very end of the destruction of the missions in Japan, which for the preceding nearly a century had created a community of about 300,000 Christians in Japan, thanks to the efforts of Jesuit missionaries from Portugal, from Spain, from Italy, and to Japanese converts as well, who created this church. And what happens in the beginning of the 17th century there, there's a crackdown, an official crackdown that sees Christianity as a foreign influence, that basically is a foreign influence which is potentially politically subversive. And so there is an attempt to destroy and to uproot this Christian community by killing off every last one of the priests and basically forcing all of the laymen and women to apostatize, to give up Christianity, to become Buddhists. Many of these people who had been Christians for two or three generations by this point, as I suggested. This is a story of 100 years. So the movie tells us almost the epilogue to that story, because no one hitherto among the European priests had apostatized. They had all died as martyrs, and there had been hundreds of them. And this is the story of the one priest who said, okay, I can't take the torture anymore, and decided it was more virtuous to give up rather than to submit to further torture.
Well, let's take a listen now to a clip from Silence. Here you hear Liam Neeson as Ferreira talking to Father Rodriguez, played by Andrew Garfield.
Don't speak to me. You have no right to speak to me.
Oh, I do. Because you are just like me. You see Jesus in Gethsemane and believe your trial is the same as his. Those five in the pit are suffering too, just like Jesus. But they don't have your pride. They would never compare themselves to Jesus. Do you have the right to make them suffer? I heard the cries of suffering in this same cell, and I acted.
You excuse yourself! You excuse yourself! That is the spirit of darkness!
And what would you do for them? Pray? And get what in return? Only more suffering. A suffering only you can end. Not God!
Away from me!
I pray too, Rodriguez. It doesn't help. Go on. Pray. But pray with your eyes open.
Liam Brockie, what does that scene say to you about prayer and suffering and really about what those missionaries were doing at that point in Japan?
In the real historical tale that's told in the movie, the arrival of more missionaries after Christianity has been outlawed, after most of the priests to the last man, and the last man is Cristóvão Ferreira, have been hunted down and captured and tortured, many of them to death, what's happening here is that the arrival of more priests will produce more suffering, will produce more persecutions. And that argument is being used against Rodriguez, who shows up in order to try to recapture, if you will, rekindle the faith in Cristóvão Ferreira, and also to try and shore up to the extent that he can. Of course, he doesn't speak Japanese. The Christianity as practiced by the peasants who he meets, who are still Christians living in the shadows. And basically what the argument that's being made is, you coming here to Japan, you think you're doing God's work, but indeed what's happening is you're merely making the persecutors work even more forcefully to destroy, and in destroying, they will kill more lives beyond your own.
Liam, you're a historian, and I'm sure you hear from people who would say, you know, those Europeans shouldn't have been there. You know, their being in Japan opened the country possibly to the threat of European interference. How do you answer that point?
Well, I answer that by saying that this is not a story about colonialism, because Japan did not experience colonialism in the same way that South America did, that North America did. It did not have the arrival of European armies and their minions of European colonial states to create a Christian church at the point of the sword. The Jesuit missionaries who show up in Japan in the 16th century are by themselves. They come with Portuguese merchants who leave them off at the ports. And then these Jesuit missionaries invest in learning Japanese culture and create a Christianity that is very much in tune with Japanese culture. They adapt Christian norms to Japanese culture, and that is they use Japanese language in so much as possible. They dress like Japanese. Their churches look like Japanese buildings. Mm-hmm. This process of cultural accommodation is an adaptation of Christianity. It's not the imposition of European forms of Christianity. That's why Christianity looks very, very different in Japan than it does, say, in Mexico, say, in the Philippines. And so it's difficult to say this is a story of colonialism and this is just Europeans going and destroying indigenous cultures. That's very clearly not the case here in Japan.
Liam, what kinds of questions did you get asked? How were you able particularly to help the Scorsese team get the details right?
Well, they asked a lot of questions about the dress of the missionaries, about the type of things that the missionaries would have had with them. That is, in a couple of scenes, for example, there's a scene that shows when they're saying a mass. And in the saying of the mass, the question was, well, what things do you need to say a mass that a missionary would have actually had with him in order to say a mass? And then working with the props department to get the items that they had correct. So they open a book, and the book has to be a book that's turned to a page which shows the beginning of the Mass. It can't be something that's out of place, a singing of the Psalms or something else. It actually has to be the prayers of the Mass because that's what they're using. Another example are when the missionaries talk and they say certain things that sound like they make sense because we recognize them in our English-inflected culture of Christianity. There was a lot of back and forth over getting the phrases right so they would make sense first in Jesuits' thought and also in 16th century and 17th century Roman Catholicism, keeping in mind that the English in the world that we inherited through our culture are not Roman Catholics. They're Anglicans or other forms of Protestants. So what we see is we have to make this movie Catholicism that makes sense. We have to make it Jesuits who make sense in the 17th century, and we have to make it the Japanese reception of that Catholicism that makes sense, a missionary Catholicism. Those are all the things that I work on, that I study in my work, and that I was able to suggest go more in this direction or don't emphasize that so much, rather focus on this theme in the words that the missionaries use.
Liam, what was it like for you to sit in a theater and see something that you have spent so many years studying and teaching and writing about brought to life?
That's the most exciting part of this, because for so much of the back and forth that I went through with the production team, and it was about 3 years of responding to emails and telephone calls and the like, sort of taking them to the limits of historical knowledge. That is, we're talking about an affair that happened 300 years ago on the other side of the world, of which we have very few documentary traces. And so to recreate that world, which is what I do in my head when I make my historical investigation, and when I do my research and write on these things, to see it on the screen is really amazing, because what it does is it takes my imagination and it projects it onto the screen. Not that it is my vision. Indeed, it's not. It's Martin Scorsese's vision. But what it suggests to me is that I was a good communicator of a lot of the things that I talked about in my research and the communications that I had with them, so that they were able to transmit some of my imagination to the screen as well.
Liam Baracchi, Michigan State University professor of history and consultant to director Martin Scorsese on his latest film, Silence. Liam, thank you so much for talking with us today and taking our questions on Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. As Michigan's brewing industry continues to grow and flourish, we're seeing a big jump in growing hops in our state. Consider this. Prior to 2008, Michigan didn't have a commercial hop-growing operation, hadn't had one for more than a century, and now we're fourth in the nation. Let's look at the revival of Michigan's hops industry. Rob Sarine is here. He's a senior extension educator at Michigan State University. Rob, how are hops used in brewing?
Well, there's two different types of hops and dual-purpose hops. So hops are used in brewing for their bittering aspect and then also for aroma. And you also have dual-purpose hops that can do a little bit of both.
And how far back does commercial hops production go in Michigan?
Well, it's interesting looking at some of the ag census data from the mid-early 1800s. I think around 1865 might have been the heyday in Michigan. We had about 400 acres of hops in the state. Back in that day, most of the hops were grown in New York State. And as they moved kind of west, Michigan picked up a little, and then Wisconsin, and then out to California, and then back up into the Yakima Valley and Willamette Valley.
Why did it die out in Michigan? We had such a long stretch where there was nothing happening.
Hops are grown primarily right now out in the Yakima Valley in the high desert area where they get about 10 inches of precipitation a year, probably more this year because it's been a strange year out there. But so hops can get diseases. Downy mildew is a pretty significant disease that we have to keep an eye on. Powdery mildew is another one. And also back in the day, they had aphids as well that they had to contend with. So I think it was a combination of probably downy mildew and aphids that really kind of caused the industry to look for better ground out west and better growing conditions.
So what kicked it back to life here in Michigan? To the point, I mean, when we're number four among states that produce hops, that's pretty good progress in less than 10 years.
Right. And I can put those numbers into perspective, too. So basically, it's craft beer. The whole craft beer movement has really just kind of kicked off the whole kind of supply side, raw material side, which has been a boon to Michigan growers as they've invested in that industry. While we are number four, I'll also just say that we probably have about 1,200 acres in the ground this year, and Washington State has about 37,000. So, we do like to say we're four, exactly. And then you got Oregon and Idaho with about 7,000 and 5,000. So, yeah, people are taking notice. They do grow really well here. We've got the right soil conditions. We have the right latitude, and some folks who are really good farmers and business people willing to make the investment.
And what kind of return might folks get on that investment? What kind of money can people make from growing hops?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. Some of them will say we haven't made any money yet. We've been in it for 5 or 6 years. Part of the issue is that the infrastructure costs are pretty steep to get into the industry. So you're talking $12,000 to $15,000 an acre just to get the plants, the infrastructure, the trellis system, the irrigation, and all of that in the ground. And then you have to have the hops transported to a picking facility where the hops are separated from the rest of the vegetative material. And then they have to be dried and then processed as well into pellets for the brewing industry. So there's quite a bit of cost there involved. And, you also have your annual cost as well. So it's really difficult to kind of put one number on, a grower's net profit. But I will tell you, there's more folks investing more money into more acreage in larger facilities in Michigan.
Are we seeing small growers get into this? Is this something that people could do more on an individual level, or does it take a big operation?
Yeah, and again, that's relative too. Some of the larger hop farms out in Yakima are, 500 to a couple thousand acres of hops. Seven or eight years ago, you could start off growing hops and just see if they grew well, test different varieties on a 1 or 2 acre plot, and then maybe expand from there, because there was kind of a novelty with Michigan-grown hops. Nowadays, I think most folks are, if they're starting and they're in it to make money, not just as a passion, I think you'd have to put at least 20 acres in, if not more. Because you only use some of that equipment, 30 days out of the year, and you want to kind of maximize the efficiency of it.
Do Michigan hops wind up in Michigan beers?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think probably most of the hops grown in Michigan are used in Michigan beers, but they're also exported to other states and actually around the globe as well, increasingly.
When we talk about Michigan brewers, are we talking about the biggies like, Shorts or Bell's or Founders, or are they going to the smaller operations?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And one we like to make for folks starting up in the industry is, the big guys will buy hundreds of thousands of pounds of hops every year. But they're also getting, with that economies of scale, really probably pretty good prices from folks out west. So they will buy, increasingly I think the quality is improving here. So they're going to be purchasing more and more hops from Michigan. But for the most part, I think the vast majority of hops that are sold in Michigan are going to smaller scale breweries, brew pubs, that sort of thing, where the growers can receive a price premium, provided it's a quality product. And if you think about a Bell's or a Founders or a Shorts having to increase the price of their six packs in the store in order to pay double for a Michigan hop, that's probably not going to happen just because competition is increasing. But a brew pub, if you go in, or a tap room or something like that, you know, they can afford to pay more, you know, 50 cents more a pint, increase the price of their pint by a dollar, market it as a Michigan hop, and then kind of everyone wins.
A side of the brewing industry, a lot of us never thought of the hops that are growing in operations around Michigan. Rob Serine, Senior Extension Educator with Michigan State University. Rob, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Every single day, more than 20 million gallons of oil, some 540,000 barrels, pumps through two aging pipes that lie at the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac. Those Enbridge Line 5 pipes are the focus of a newly formed group of Michigan business leaders who want those old pipes shut down. Among those leaders is Larry Bell. He's the founder of Bell's Brewery, and he is here with us now. Larry, it's called the Great Lakes Business Network. What's the mission?
Get Line 5 removed. I think, you know, really where we're coming at this from is from a business perspective. You know, you might look at me and say, what's a guy from Kalamazoo talking about business perspective in the Straits? But as Bell's Brewery, we do a ton of business on Mackinac Island. Mm-hmm. We sponsor the great sailboat race that winds up at Mackinac Island from Port Huron, which is a great driver of tourism for both Port Huron and for Mackinac Island. So, you know, we may have 240, 250 boats full of sailors and their families who all descend upon the island. And during the sailboat racing, that's a huge amount of business for Bell's up there, not only on the island, but the whole Straits area. And then also, we own a brewery up in Escanaba called the Upper Hand Brewery. And Escanaba sources their water from Lake Michigan. Now, granted, that is a bit of a ways away from Mackinac, but still, mm-hmm. it's Lake Michigan mm-hmm. water. So what's the risk here to our businesses and to our business models? And if there's when there's a break in Line 5, what does that do from an economic and business perspective? You know, people come to Michigan, come to Mackinac Island and the Straits, pure Michigan. That's mm-hmm. the image that we project in this state, which is a great image and it's very successful. But if we lose that business, you lose all those employees, all those people that are working in the Straits area, on the island, the ferry boat people. There is the argument that's made on the other side. Enbridge employs 250 people in the state. If you close Line 5, it's not really going to affect their employment that much, but a break would devastate employment in that area, as well as how many communities that are relatively close by that also source their water from Lake Michigan.
It is mind-boggling.
Yeah, and you know, like a town like Escanaba, should Lake Michigan water be corrupted, there's no backup plan. You know, for a lot of these communities, it's not like you can just say, oh, we're going to go drop a well mm-hmm. somewhere. That may not be available to them. Again, if you've got a water issue, and we've seen what can happen in the state when you have a water issue, what happens economically, if you take a town like Charlevoix, guess what? We've got corrupted water. You know, honey, let's not go up to Charlevoix this year. Maybe
sure.
we're going somewhere else.
So,
you know, there's this whole economic sense of what would happen and what's the risk factor and is it worth it?
What are some of the other companies that have joined you in this network?
Well, I think probably most prominently would be Schepler's Ferries, Chris Schepler up there, because, I mean, that's an easy one to see. If the Straits are full of oil, Chris isn't employing his 200 employees ferrying people to and from Mackinac Island. You know, Chris is probably the most well-known of the folks, but, you know, there's other folks involved on the brewing side of things, Lake Charlevoix Brewing Company, Barfly Ventures, the Hopcat mm-hmm. people out of Grand Rapids. And then there's some other people that are helping out. A photographer who has a company up in Traverse City, who I met the other day, she's joined. And since we've announced, I've had several calls of people that want to join up. the Patagonia folks through their office in Chicago. Of course, they're very well known for taking on environmental causes. They've joined up with this, and actually at their store in Chicago, they have some great visuals about this on the wall. So it's great to have them along as well.
So how do you, as the Great Lakes Business Network, how do you hope to shut Line 5 down? You're going to pressure lawmakers, pressure anybody and everybody, and use your business clout?
Well, yeah. Back in October, the Attorney General came to see me in Kalamazoo. And to be honest, we had a really great chat about Line 5. He's very well educated about it. During the 45 minutes we sat together, mm-hmm. he taught me one thing I didn't know about Line 5.
And what was that?
I did not know that there was an on-ramp for oil south of the bridge. So if you go up to northern Michigan, you will see oil rigs, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all that oil then gets loaded into Line 5 and sent on to Sarnia. That's one of the issues that needs to be talked about. The thing I was teaching him was dealing with propane in the Upper Peninsula and who owns that equipment and how we deal with that issue, because that is also important economically. We can't balance the health of the Great Lakes on the backs of the retirees and propane users in the UP. There are some complexities to removing Line 5, but I don't think there are issues that can't be solved.
So the more you talk about it and the more you search for solutions, the closer you get.
Yeah, and I think certainly it's going to be a topic in the upcoming gubernatorial race,
where many expect Mr. Schuette to have a very prominent part.
Well, I think so. I think on the Republican side, I anticipated Schuette and Kelly, and rumor has it perhaps a Snyder-esque candidate coming from the business world. On the Democrat side, already we see Gretchen Whitmer, probably Dan Kildee, and perhaps, again, another candidate there. I was fortunate to meet with Ms. Whitmer a couple weeks ago. She came by Kalamazoo, and we discussed Line 5.
Just tugging on as many sleeves as you possibly can, you and everybody in the network, the business people in the network.
Yeah, and, you know, why do we have to have risk to our business model for their business model? And Michigan takes this risk. Our businesses take risk for oil that comes from Canada, traverses our state, and goes back to Canada. So we take all this risk for very little reward.
And you being from Kalamazoo, when you think about the rupture of the Kalamazoo River, the worst and most costly inland oil spill in U.S. history, how did that 2010 rupture kind of fuel what you're doing now?
You know, when it first happened, nobody really knew. It was upstream from us in Kalamazoo. And then the way I unfortunately got involved with this was one day I look out my office window and I see construction going on next to the brewery. After we were lied to by the construction people, we find out that it's Enbridge building a remediation pad. No site plan approval was ever done. They were opening up the fire hydrants and stealing water, which of course roiled up the water, which with brewery, we like nice, steady supply of water. So I called the township supervisor and said, "Hey, what's going on?" She says, "We didn't do anything." I said, "You better get over here." And she was over there. And long story short, I had to sue Enbridge. They were going to process 435,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil in a method that would have put some pretty heinous compounds airborne headed straight for the brewery. You know, we don't really want airborne benzene coming into our food production.
We don't want to drink that beer if it has that. You're exactly right. You're right. Yeah.
You know, and yeah. So I had to deal with them, and it was not a pleasant experience. That property now has been developed into the Kalamazoo Gourmet Grill Company. Very nice company there.
After the Great Lakes Business Network was announced, Enbridge said, "Hey, we look forward to having a chance to meet with the business leaders and talk about what we do." Have you had a chance to talk with Enbridge since the network was announced?
I have not personally. I will grant you, Enbridge is a very large company. They are very polished. They have mouthpieces that know how to manage media quite well. They will kind of stop at nothing to get their way with things. They're formidable as far as them being able to get out and buy media time. You know, they're a huge company that makes an immense amount of profit. So for them to go out and spend some millions of dollars on a media campaign is easy.
You feel like David versus Goliath?
Well, you know, it is somewhat. But I think you know, the more that we're out talking about this and getting people educated, I didn't know. Nobody knew that there was a pipeline under the Straits until we had this big accident on the Kalamazoo River. And people said, pipelines in Michigan, what's going on here and where are they? What do you mean there's one in the Straits?
And it's 63 years old.
You know, and even the attorney general has come out and said, if you applied for this today, we wouldn't give it to you. This wouldn't be permitted under today's rules, obviously, because that is the worst place in all the Great Lakes. If you were going to put a pipeline, the Straits of Mackinac would be the absolute worst place to put it. And yet that's where it is.
Larry Bell is founder of Bell's Brewery and one of the founding members of the Great Lakes Business Network formed to press lawmakers to decommission Enbridge Line 5. Larry, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Many in northern Michigan know about the raclette the Leelanau Cheese Company makes, and now the rest of the world does as well. Just a few months ago, the company's mild raclette variety of cheese won a Super Gold Award at the World Cheese Awards in Spain. This is one of the highest cheese awards you can get, people. Dan Washura stopped by Sutton's Bay and talked with the owners, who say winning a Super Gold makes the hard work worth it.
It's a little past 8 o'clock, and Ann Hoyt is already in the middle of another day of cheese making. Ann and John Hoyt own Leelanau Cheese Company in Sutton's Bay.
This is my husband, John.
Hi, John.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
Leelanau Cheese is famous for its raclette.
When people ask what it tastes like, I often say it's between a Gouda and a Gruyere. That's exactly what raclette is.
Just about every other day, they drive their small tanker truck, called the Milky Way, to a local dairy farm. This morning, they picked up about 300 gallons of milk. Back home, they pump the milk through hoses into a giant kettle inside the creamery. They pump the milk slowly. Ann says they don't want to make whipped cream. Then, they pasteurize it.
While you were in the garage earlier, I turned the boiler switch on there, so that gets the steam going and big, huge boiler in the back there, so steam is coming through the pipes. And we'll heat to 145 to pasteurize. We'll hold that for 30 minutes.
Raclette comes from Switzerland. It gets its name from the French verb racler, which means to scrape. Folks would put the cheese in front of a fire and then scrape the melted stuff on top of some boiled potatoes. Mix in some pickled gherkins and onions, and voila. John Hoyt was in Switzerland working for a winemaker when he experienced a raclette dinner for the first time.
I actually said at that moment, my God, why don't we have this in America?
John loves the aged raclette. That's what he's always trying to steal out of a corner there, a piece of the aged raclette, like he owns the place.
Ann Hoyt was born in France. You might have guessed that.
That French accent, you know.
She met John in Switzerland. She was working as a shepherd, and John was finishing up an apprenticeship with a cheesemaker.
Well, you know, he was young and handsome, and he had an accent, which was just wonderful to have that American accent in the mountains of Switzerland. I mean, so unique. And I guess we fell in love right there, I think.
The couple eventually moved to Michigan, got married in a Detroit courthouse, and Anne became a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, I'm one of you.
Back in the creamery, John gets ready for the next step after pasteurization.
So what are you doing there, John?
Adding cultures.
It's like a powder?
This is kind of proprietary thing, so I'm not going to get too deep into it, all right?
He sprinkles a packet of freeze-dried powdery stuff into the big kettle of milk. Cultures are basically good bacteria. Since pasteurization kills both good and bad bacteria in the milk, cultures are added to develop the cheese flavor.
It's part of the secret.
Yeah, that's kind of your secret sauce, huh?
Yeah.
The cheese cellar is dug into the side of a hill. This is where the cheese ages.
Ooh, it's bright out there.
It's humid inside, and about 55 degrees. Rows and rows of cheese wheels sit on stacked boards.
So here are my babies. It's a pretty empty cellar right now at this time of the year.
A mild raclette variety spends about 3 months here, while the aged raclette stays about 10 months.
And you can see the difference of colors. Like, this is really white, okay? And as they age, very slowly, they get a little bit darker. They get that beautiful, creamy, yellowish color slowly. This is older. This is younger. You can really see the difference.
John and Ann started their cheese business out of a garage in Omena in 1995. They eventually moved into Black Star Farms for a while, and then to their current location in Sutton's Bay 3 years ago. Their focus has been to specialize, to be good at one or two varieties instead of making a whole bunch of different kinds. And that strategy seems to have paid off as customers from all around the country order cheese from them. And cheese experts have also taken notice. Just a few months ago, Leelanau Cheese Company won a Super Gold Award at the 2016 World Cheese Awards for their mild raclette. The competition was held in Spain and included over 3,000 different cheese varieties from 6 different continents. Winning a Super Gold Award means the cheese was one of the top 66 cheeses overall, and one of only 2 varieties to win from the United States.
It's like winning a gold medal at the Olympic Games, so it's such a great feeling. This is, you know, putting Michigan on the world cheese map. It's just great. It's great.
For Stateside, I'm Dan Wanchura.
Dan Wanchura hosts The Green Room. It's a weekly arts and culture podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. You can subscribe to a show on iTunes. A Valentine's Day postcard arrived today from a friend of ours, former Michigan radio staffer, now with NPR, Tamar Charney. And it reads, "Dear Stateside, I found a heart on the shore of Lake Michigan.
It was a stone that had washed up in a storm on New Year's Day. It was lying there in the sand with a bunch of other rocks, but this one stood out because it was shaped like a perfect Valentine's Day heart. The time between New Year's and Valentine's Day is when we all swear we're going to get our act together. Gyms are full of people trying to get in shape, everyone's on a diet, and all those resolutions are in full swing. But then come Valentine's Day, we crash and lose our drive to make over our lives. Blame the chocolates and heart-shaped boxes if you want, but they aren't the problem. The problem is the whole premise of this holiday. It's one big festival of gauzy romantic love that exists only on a Hallmark card or in a 1980s John Hughes movie. Valentine's Day smacks you upside the head with the realization that your love life will never, ever, possibly measure up, and all the New Year's resolutions in the world won't win you the happiness that comes from love like that. So we give up. We resign ourselves to our pathetic, seemingly loveless lives. But not so fast. The problem is what Valentine's Day is celebrating. What if Valentine's Day wasn't about the fantasy version of romantic love? What if it was about the kinds of love that really make a difference in our lives? Because there isn't just one kind of love. Sure, there's romantic love with all its real-world blessings and curses. But what about unrequited love and past loves, love of family and love for friends, the animals we love, the kids we love, the food we love, the music we love, the places we love? Love of self, and love of life. There's so many types of love, each with its own joys and its own sorrows. Each one plays a part in making us who we are. And at any given time, one kind of love may be going strong, while another fades away. So if you look for more than one idealized sort of love, you may find it washes up every day in unexpected places, like that heart-shaped stone. You just have to know to look for it wherever you are. And that is worth celebrating. Happy Valentine's Day, loves.
Tamar Charney is the managing editor for NPR One and the former program director here at Michigan Radio. That's our show for this Valentine's Day. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.